Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. Quick reminder that you can subscribe to us on all the major podcast platforms, Google Play, iTunes, Stitcher, a bunch of things that probably I ought to know about, but I don't. Now, this is interesting because I'm broadcasting from San Francisco. Actually, I'm across the bay from San Francisco in Sausalito. I can actually see the city from where I am sitting. And we're joined by Tim Miller, who is like almost here. You're in Oakland.
East Bay.
Yeah, and it's the middle of the afternoon. All the people in Washington, D.C. are complaining it's so late. Oh, my God, you have to work. It's 3 hours late. It's the middle of the afternoon for us, right?
Being on Pacific time is lovely. You know, I mean, you do have the cost of living and the taxes and the, you know, Antifa to deal with out here. But the time zones, the weather, everything else is pretty wonderful.
Earthquakes, fires.
The earthquakes are kind of fun as long as they're just the little ones. It's the big ones, I guess, are mildly concerning.
Yes. So if you're not being swallowed alive by the earth or burned alive by wildfires or beaten to death by Antifa thugs, it's great. It's perfect. It's a lifestyle.
So I actually
flew out here from Milwaukee through Dallas, and I was on this American flight, and I figured, and they had, you know, very, very effective Wi-Fi, and I was able to write an article. Well, I want to talk about it a little bit later for the Bulwark about Bill Barr, the 7 reasons I don't trust Bill Barr. But the big shock was I have a nice laptop, you know, an HP laptop. But I haven't flown steerage in American lately. And apparently they've cut like 7 or 8 inches off the length of the seats, whatever you have. So I set this thing up and it's like right on my stomach. It's like, are you kidding me? I'm going to have like little alligator arms just to type on this thing. But
it's not a great angle for laptop life.
No, it is not American. No, and I'm not trying to break bad on American. It's just that I was a little bit surprised. I figured I might have a little bit of elbow room, but you know, I had a certain amount of pride that I was able to get work done at 35,000 feet and actually email it off and still have a beer.
Usually, you can blame Jonathan Last for your typos, but tomorrow you can just blame the alligator arms and steerage.
That's right. 35,000 feet, talking about Bill Barr and how he's transforming himself into a political hack, but I don't want to get to that first. I want to have a joint rant about the whole Joe Biden thing first. You had a piece in the Bulwark a couple of days ago, and about the woke attacks on Joe Biden, and this is one of my obsessions as well. This weird transformation of the Me Too movement from genuine sexual harassment, sexual assault, to being in someone's space. So, you know, and by the way, you're not a Joe Biden fan, are you?
I'm not a Joe Biden fan. I mean, you know, we live in very troubled times with our political choices. So a lot of times you have to choose the least smelly urinal. I've not been a longtime Biden fan. My second campaign actually was in Delaware. Was not against Biden, but was, you know, working for a governor candidate there. And so, you know, the dislike for Biden among the small cohort of Delaware Republicans is pretty intense. And so they tried to indoctrinate me. But, you know, obviously campaigned against him twice for McCain and Romney when he was on the VP ticket. And I was going back through my old tweets, and I have some gems, some nice zingers against Biden during his Paul Ryan debate in 2012.
That was obnoxious. Yeah.
Yeah. It does not come from a place of, you know, any particular like for Biden. He might end up being better than some of our other options when everything shakes out, but, absolutely. The thing that has been most bothersome to me and, you know, to get into the article is just that, like, these critics of him. And when I talk about the critics, I'm not, I just want to say, clearly up front that I'm not talking about the women who have spoken out and said that they're made to feel uncomfortable. Absolutely. If you are in a situation where somebody in power makes you feel uncomfortable, you should be able to speak out. And that's been a good side of the Me Too movement. I'm talking about the people that have taken those women's testimonies and attacked Biden in the most bad faith ways possible, to the point where it's like these people don't even believe their own arguments. You know, whether it's the Trumpers you know, that's absurd in its own unique way, or, you know, kind of the Democrats who just obviously clearly don't want him to be the nominee and are now trying to use this against him and turn him into some kind of, you know, sex creeper, or sexual molester. It's horrible. It's horrible.
Yeah, I mean, I think I've talked about this before. It's one of those things where it's almost like a virtual scandal that somebody out there must be outraged about this. You don't actually know anyone who's outraged about it. You're personally not outraged about it, but you know that he once rubbed noses with a woman, and therefore he should not run for president of the United States. It's not usually a good faith argument. What I thought was interesting in your piece, though, and I actually want to play a little bit of it as well, that, you know, in order to understand Joe Biden, and again, you and I are not Joe Biden, you know, supporters necessarily, as you point out, that in order to understand him, you really have to go back to, you know, some of the life experiences he's had, that you describe him as an expert in the management of grief. He knows on a deep personal level, you write, the primal human need for connection. And you link to this 2012 speech that you describe as one of the most wrenching and raw speeches from a politician in the past decade, speaking in front of families of fallen soldiers at the Tragedy Assistance Program for Survivors. And it's embedded in your piece, in your piece. And really, you get a sense of, you know, the fact that there's a lot more going on here. This is not Harvey Weinstein. This is not somebody who is just, who is grabbing and groping women. This is not a pussy grabber. This is someone who has deep empathy and feels the need to physically connect. So tell me a little bit. Can we just play a little bit of? We're going to drop in a little bit of this because I want to get a sense where he's talking about the death of his first wife and his daughter and his car wreck and what that was. Let's just play a little bit because in order to understand, I think the point you're making, Tim, people need to actually hear a little bit of this.
I could be wearing one of those red shirts, not for the military, but when I was a 29-year-old kid, I got elected to the United States Senate out of nowhere on November the 7th. And I got a phone call like you guys got, or someone walking up to me. On December 18th, I was down in Washington. I'm the first United States Senator I ever knew. And I was down in Washington hiring my staff, and I got a phone call saying that my family had been in an accident. And just like you guys know, by the tone of a phone call, you just knew, didn't you? You knew when they walked up the path. You knew when the call came. You knew. You just felt it in your bones. Something bad happened. And I knew. I don't know how I knew. But the call said, my wife was dead. My daughter was dead, and I wasn't sure how my sons were going to make it. A Christmas shopping and a tractor trailer broadsided them, and in one instant, killed two of them. Well, when I have to tell you, I used to resent. I knew people meant well. They'd come up to me and say, Joe, I know how you feel. Right? You knew they meant well. You knew they were genuine. But you knew they didn't have any damn idea how you felt. Right? Isn't that true? I mean, that black hole you feel in your chest like you're being sucked back into it. Looking at your kids and most of you have kids here. And knowing, it was the first time in my career, my life, I realized someone could go out, and I probably shouldn't say this to the press here, but no, but it's more important. You're more important. For the first time in my life, I understood how someone could consciously decide to commit suicide. Not because they were deranged, not because they were nuts, because they'd been to the top of the mountain and they just knew in their heart they'd never get there again, that there was never going to be that way ever again. That's how an awful lot of you feel. And by the way, to the moms and dads, no parent should be predeceased by their son or daughter. I unfortunately have that experience too. But you know what? I don't know about you guys, but I was angry. Man, I was angry.
This is a moment where, and this is very unusual, in even for somebody who's been around politics as long as Joe Biden, to expose himself this way and to connect with people. So how do you draw the connection between that and this fake controversy we're having?
Yeah, I mean, there are two things. One is it speaks to the intent. Right. And you sort of alluded to this, and I did too, a little cheekily, but in a serious way, you know, the main perpetrators of Me Too, the perpetrators who have been held to account, like Harvey Weinstein and Eric Schneiderman, and those who have not really been held to account, like the president, you know, what drives their actions are, you know, varying. It's either, you know, ego boosting, need to demean women, other sort of, you know, psychological issues. And, you know, if you listen to the president himself bragging to Billy Bush about this, you can hear exactly why, you know, he does this. You know, he moves on them like a bitch, right? They just let you do it because you're famous. It's an ego boost, right? I can walk backstage and see, you know, the models getting dressed, the underage models at the pageant, right? And they just let you do it. And he's bragging about it, right? It's all about this narcissism. So that's what drives us. And you know, obviously it's different for different people. But what the Biden, you know, whatever you want to call it, inappropriate touching or space invading, you know, comes from literally the 180 degree opposite place, and I didn't use literally there as a Biden block, which maybe would have worked. But from the 180 degree opposite place, right? Biden is genuinely trying to make a connection. He's trying to you know, be a salve, to ease people's pain, to make people feel comfortable, you know, if they're in an uncomfortable setting going into, you know, the White House. But a lot of these instances are times where people are grieving. And I think that is where this conversation could come to a very genuine place, right? Which is, when people are grieving, what do they need? And there are certain people that have given testimonies that have said, Biden, you know, came to me at a time when I was struggling. You know, there's a woman I read about in Omaha who I read about, who said I it was after an event and my son had just died, and he like pulled me aside and embraced me and let me tell my story, and it just made me feel so much better, right? And then there's some other women who've come forth and said, you know, at a time that was so sensitive, I did not want my space to be invaded like that.
Sure.
Right? Like, that's humans. But the intent in each of those cases from Biden's standpoint was wanting to, you know, commune with these people, make them feel better. And you see that in his speeches. He talks about the need to hang on to one another, and, you know, in a very visceral language that he uses. That to even put that in the same, you know, under the same Me Too umbrella as grabbing women by the pussy is offensive. And you know, it shows how unhealthy our dialogue around all this has become.
People should go online and watch the whole speech and read your piece, because you go on to say, you know, as Vice President Biden was called on to grieve with people more times than most of us could bear. Parents who'd lost their kids at Sandy Hook, and that had to stop right there. A mother who'd lost children to meningitis, a man who'd lost two children and a grandchild. And then 5 years later, it was Biden who was facing this unimaginable grief again when his son Beau passed away. And you quote a political writer, Michael Cruz, who talked to people at Beau's funeral who were just amazed at how Biden wound up consoling other people. People were just coming up and bawling in his arms. And I can hear him saying, yes, it's going to be all right. It's going to be all right. And then, of course, we had that, you know, the story of Stephanie Carter, the wife of Ash Carter, you know, that kind of went viral, where it looked like he was, you know, creepy, being all creepy. And she's written that Biden was actually giving her support on a very tough day. And it was the mob that descended on her afterward asking about it that was what made her uncomfortable. So, yeah, this is a very, very different story, and it's a context, but it is a marker of our politics and our culture. There's a lot of reasons. If you don't want to vote for Joe Biden, don't vote for him. He's too liberal. He's too conservative. He's too old, whatever. But, just show a little bit of grace in this particular moment.
Yeah, and this is why I wrote about this. If people would just step back for a second before they fired off the tweet, attacking him, like, think about what this person has been through. Biden lost a wife and a daughter, a couple decades later loses his son. And this is his manner. This is how he deals with it. And so as a lot of the people on the left were doing, coming out and saying, well, he's canceled. This is the news now. Biden's canceled now. Who are you? Like, what have you been through to do this? And the motivations of all of these folks. Now, again, not all the motivations of most of these people. There's certainly some that have genuine discomfort here. But that's not who I'm speaking about. But the motivations of the Bernie supporters who just see this as an opportunity, or as kind of the intersectional woke crowd who see an opportunity, or most disgustingly, the Trump PAC put up that ad that's like, our children are watching.
Oh, come on.
Screw you.
Yeah.
Our children are watching you, right now. And so it's just, there's plenty to go after Biden on. There's no shortage. I mean, I started linking them at the bottom and then I got bored, right? I mean, whether it's policy issues or gaffes, there's plenty of things that you can be genuinely upset about. But to be so upset about, somebody who is, trying to, deal with his grief and work through his grief and help other people deal with theirs in a way, and to turn that into some sort of sexual, sick.
It did occur to me reading your piece, though, that a lot of the conventional wisdom was, how he was damaged and how the story wasn't going away. Yeah. After reading your piece, I'm thinking, he could actually emerge from this stronger if there is a wider conversation about what we are talking about right now, getting to know him. Because, frankly didn't really have a sense of this. I mean, I knew about the tragedies, but you put those in the back of your mind. You put those in the categories. But the whole 360 if you're right, last time we talked about, what makes a political, a presidential run successful. It's not the white papers. It's not the policy papers. It's not where you stand necessarily. It's whether you have whether you connect with people. And I could certainly imagine that to the extent that people are willing to pay attention to this, this is not going to hurt him. Okay, let's switch
gears. Yeah, just really quick.
Sure.
I think that there are a couple of some political questions about how he's handled it. I mean, he did kind of know this was coming, and, so we'll see if he still does have it. You know what I mean? I just think now, putting aside, putting on the political analyst hat, I think it's an open question about whether, this passed him by. But I will say this, just because you were on the plane. Yeah. There have been two polls that have come out about this. Just today, one from Quinnipiac was just of California voters, but only 24% of Dem primary voters even considered this to be an issue. 24 yes, 71 no. And then asking whether it affected their vote, a separate poll Business Insider did had just 13% said they were a disqualifier. And frankly, that could just be the 13% that were already for Bernie or whoever anyway, just saying, there's no evidence that those 13% were people that were with him and now it's a disqualifier. So I do think this is showing that this is another one example of the phenomenon of things that are not breaking through with real voters that just seem to be everywhere on the fake outrage social media sites.
Shockingly, it turns out once again that Twitter is not real life. As I said, this is an awkward segue because this is sort of from the from the sacred to the profane. You had your piece up about Joe Biden. I've got a piece up about Bill Barr, and we actually have a debate internally at the Bulwark about whether or not we should give Bill Barr the benefit of the doubt. And there are some people who think that, look, the guy's been a former attorney general. He's very well respected. Why would he mislead anyone about the Mueller investigation since everything is going to come out? So this would make no sense. To which my response is, have you been paying attention to the number of people who have set themselves, their reputations on fire in the era of Trump? And I got to say that, my Barr skepticism runs pretty deep. I was skeptical well before he actually was confirmed, but after he released that Cliff's Notes version of the Mueller report, I was thinking, there were so many problems with that that I wrote a piece saying that he was an unreliable narrator. But watching him this week, it's actually a lot worse. And I understand that people, you know, want to think the best of folks. But I have to tell you that there's almost been a certain naivete in the coverage of this guy because, you know, I mean, let me you know, by the way, are you a Bill Barr fan?
Well, it's funny that we're taping this at a time where I might have argued with you yesterday because a fan, certainly not a fan, but I was leaning more into the camp of giving him the benefit of the doubt. But boy, today, you know, his sort of flippant comment about how he was concerned that you know, there were people at the top levels of the FBI that were spying on the Trump campaign. Did you see this? And then, and then he gets, you know, they take a break or whatever, go to lunch. And then he gets followed up with, I think it was Shaheen, one of the Democratic senators, asked him, okay, well, specifically, do you have evidence of this? Or is there something specific that concerned you that you've seen in reviewing the documents? And he really walked that back. And I thought that for... that is an extremely serious charge, and one that's been at the core of a lot of the conspiracy theorizing among the Trump crowd. And so, to just kind of flippantly throw that out there and then not provide anything and kind of awkwardly walk it back, that has started to move me more into the Sykes camp on him a little bit. I mean, it remains to be. I don't think there's a secret bombshell in the report, but I think that he's putting his thumb on the scale.
Very much. Actually, that's an analogy that I would. He's not overtly lying about it, but the thumb on the scale. And by the way, that point where he throws out the yes, he believes that they were spying on the Trump campaign. That's my number seven. Of this. See, I think
I'll have to read it tomorrow.
You have to start at the beginning. I mean, what is the prime principle? I mean, the fundamental, you know, irreducible fact that Bill Barr is Donald Trump's handpicked attorney general. Just stop right there. And we know what Trump was looking for in attorney general because he told us he wanted a Roy Cohn. He wanted somebody who would see his job as to protect him, Donald Trump, before anything else. I mean, we watched what he did with Jeff Sessions, whose great crime was that he recused himself, that he didn't shut down the Mueller investigation. And so we knew that. And, you know, and we watched this president who made it clear that he was completely prepared to, you know, obstruct this investigation, you know, not in secret. I mean, that's the thing that we kind of have to remind ourselves of. I mean, he was doing it on Twitter. This is not stuff that's caught on wiretaps. He's doing it under the Klieg lights and, you know, dangling pardons and attacking witnesses and firing the FBI director. And there's Bill Barr, who basically says, yeah, I'd like this job. Pick me. And my resume is this 19-page memo or whatever, unsolicited memo that basically says, I don't believe that you can be charged with obstruction of justice under most circumstances. And that's his freaking audition is essentially saying, you know, you pick me and you don't have to worry about obstruction of justice. Then amazingly, he does exactly that. I mean, he really does when you think about it. And you know, puts out this 4-page memo that's so bad that you have members of the Mueller team who are now saying, "Look, he didn't fairly represent, you know, what we did. What a surprise!" And then, of course, you had this week, and you're the point you just made about that he's throwing out Donald Trump's favorite talking point. You know, he sounds like he's wants to guest host with Sean Hannity, but also I thought it was weird. When they asked him, did you share this with the White House? And he wouldn't answer the question. And he danced around the question because the easiest, most obvious answer is no, I didn't share it with the White House. And then he hems and he haws and he dances around. And then he says, well, I kind of gave him a heads up a little bit earlier. They haven't actually read it. But this is one of those. And then, of course, you know, the fact that we're going to, you know, see the report with all the redactions, including redactions of grand jury information. And I understand that you're not allowed to release certain grand jury information unless you go to court and you get permission to release it, like Ken Starr did. Everything in the grand jury investigation was released. That's possible. And he's asked about it, and Bill Barr says, yeah, I'm not going to do that. Well, so much for any effort at transparency. So I guess I'm calling bullshit on this guy. You know, I mean, it's a... And,
The thing that sticks with me in that rant, Shirley, is good rant, because you know, I have my heart is full as far as like contempt is concerned. Like I can't, my meter cannot take any more people to have contempt for, or else it will explode inside my chest. And so like I've been trying.
You're rationing it. To be honest,
I just have not been, you know, when Barr got the job, I didn't think about it in the way that you just laid out, right? Which is like, given what you already know about Donald Trump and given what he's already said he's going to do about this investigation, regardless of the underlying facts, to want to be the person to put yourself in that situation. And I remember Pruitt was sort of semi-lobbying for the AG job at one point earlier in the administration when I still had room left for contempt. And one of his political advisors kind of just, you know, obviously knew I was going to be opposed to it, given my stance on Trump, but just sort of wanted to talk it through. And that was kind of the point that I made at the time, which is like, why? Like, you're putting yourself in the situation, given what Trump has already said, where, you know, unless you are going to come in to be the white knight to stand up to him, which doesn't seem like a Barr, thing, then you're basically conceding that you're going to be willing to, you know, put your thumb on the scale to keep him happy. And so, I think that's a compelling argument just for the fact that anybody that would volunteer to go take this job, given what Trump had publicly done, isn't 100% on the level.
Yeah, and I didn't even mention Matthew Whitaker. I mean, in terms of like,
okay, yeah, I tried to block him out altogether.
You see, I mean, that's like a bad memory. It's like some bad fish you had once. But in case there was any doubt about what Trump was expecting from the Department of Justice, that he would put an unqualified hack, who's literally only his qualification was his willing to be as servile as possible to Donald Trump. It was just an embarrassment. And even with all that, Bill Barr said, yeah, I can do that job. I'm the guy you are looking for. By the way, I think your rationing of contempt is a very, very good idea, because otherwise you would. I mean, if you wake up every morning, you go, OK, listen, I just got a certain amount. So should it be Stephen Miller and Seb Gorka? Or should it be some random member of the cabinet? You know, go with Stephen Miller, right?
I've locked down Herman Cain. You know, I'm like, I can't. Okay. I'm not going to get outraged about this one. Maybe if I was a finance guy. So that's the level of contempt I won't take.
You threw it in the chum, you know, because here's Herman Cain. And the way this is going to play out is going to be interesting, because Herman Cain is so bad for Fed. This might have actually been a plan. Because Stephen Moore was a joke for the Federal Reserve.
Right.
But now everybody's going, okay, well, Stephen Moore, at least he's not Herman Cain.
Right.
Herman Cain is actually putting out emails saying, hey, little known financial trick can turn $100 into $800,000. Put me on that. It's like, what? What
do you get? Are you sure that wasn't a Daily Caller email, Charlie?
Oh, man. But that's the environment you're from. They're from this ecosystem.
Yeah.
Scammers.
I guess that's the point. Maybe Moore could eke out the 50 votes. It's hard to imagine that Cain can get the votes. Maybe I'll have some contempt reserves that I can build up between now and then if he actually gets 50 votes.
Well, no, and I'm not arguing against the rationing. I'm just saying that it is hard. You can't keep going. I mean, you do see the people who do not ration contempt. You see them on Twitter, and you know what they're all doing? They're all losing their freaking minds. I mean, you can just tell that the folks who are having nervous breakdowns on a regular basis, that it's just like they can't take it anymore. It's like they've been working up, and then they just click on, and there's a video of Candace Owens, and then they just lose it. It's just, that's it. I can't.
I rationed Candace, too.
That's right.
Rationed Candace. Somebody sent me a tweet by, I'm not even going to say who, but one of the a congressman defending her, and I was just like, you know what? I'm logging off. I'm moving over to Nuggets Twitter. We got the NBA playoffs coming up here.
Yeah,
you know,
I'm
stepping aside of the Candace Owens one. There are too many serious things to be upset about.
Yeah, this is the good advice we can give people, that most of you are out there. You're not, you know, where you're one Charlie Kirk or Candace Owens away from just losing it. I mean, that's it. You're gone. I mean, it's like life is a precious thing. You know, your attention is important. So, my problem is that I actually fight against being numbed by this stuff. I will admit that there are times when I go, yeah, so here's another person behaving like a complete idiot who's doing all of this. You know, what do we know? because I mean, it is a marathon, and we may have another 5 years of all of this together.
It's a fair balance of concern, and honestly, the other side of it is, for those of us who are not, kind of power Twitter users, power news followers, you do notice this. I'm sure you do too, Charlie, in your life, that people who were predisposed to dislike the president, call them whatever you want, Republican types, conservative types, but kind of have been numbed, right, to the daily outrages, right? And to the point where it's just kind of like, well, I guess I'll go along with this guy. So going ahead to 2020, there is, in addition to self-care and mental health concerns, I think there already also is a strategic approach for people that don't like Trump, right, which is to really dial up the outrage when it's deserved, so that these gettable voters don't become totally numbed and maybe take a pass on a few swings aren't deserved.
See, this is part of the problem with people who are on cable television all the time. Certain shows on certain cable networks that I'd rather not go into, where they apparently do feel the need that every single day it's dialed up to 10. And so whatever it is, whatever, a sixth level gaffe turns into, oh my God, it's Hitler again. And that's right. Like, no, come on, wait for the actual Hitler moment. Among the things speaking of things that I should have rationed, I do find Mayor Pete to be very interesting, and I really like the fact that he's trying to engage in what seems like a rational and reasonable debate about the role of faith and the role of faith with his own personal identity. I mean, he's taken some shots at Mike Pence he's getting some blowback. But it is also interesting the number of folks who, this debate, I don't know if you've seen it, Mayor Pete isn't a real, doesn't understand Christianity because he's an Episcopalian, because they're not real. And this appears to be serious. And see, my wife's an Episcopalian, and I can joke with her about, Episcopalians being sort of, agnostics at prayer type thing. But you can just see the way this is going to play out in 2020. And, he thought was very strong on Meet the Press, talking about the hypocrisy of evangelical Christians who are okay with Donald Trump's personal life. And then you see the people attacking him. Well, how can he raise those issues considering that he's a gay man, therefore living in sin? And then quoting Leviticus
there have been I have a couple thoughts of this because I have been following this one closely. I forget the exact number, but I think that there have been 11 Episcopalian presidents, so it seems pretty interesting that the gay one would be the first one that doesn't qualify as a Christian. Somehow the other Episcopalian presidents, there were never any revising them out of the faith, I think that he's obviously liberal. There's no kind of, it's the way that he could appeal to, I think, Romney Clinton voters, if you will, is less on ideology and more on kind of style and background and change. And I think that there are, he's been willing to buck, kind of the mob, which is the thing that's been most appealing to me. I think he was asked by BuzzFeed about Chick-fil-A. BuzzFeed's looking for a click story about, Pete Buttigieg, the gay candidate, attacks Chick-fil-A. And he's just kind of like, I don't know, man. I eat Chick-fil-A. You can drive yourself crazy, boycotting every company you don't agree with politically, right?
Not exactly a sister soldier moment, but the closest thing we've gotten to one.
Astute politically, but I also think he was just being honest, right? I just think he was giving his honest answer on that. And so he talks like a human. I like that. He's willing to kind of buck the woke mob. The faith that he is, by all accounts, legitimately a person of faith. And, you pointed out the really crass and ridiculous attacks against him on his faith. But, Selena Zito, who's been, pretty kind of populist MAGA-ish. It's unfair to call her MAGA-ish, I guess, but you know what I mean, reporter. Mm-hmm. She did an interview with him and talked about how, this is a man of deep faith, a person that doesn't talk down to people that voted for Trump. Sometimes it's just things that are as small as that, right? That actually speaking to, voters who feel like that they have been condescended to by liberal coastal elites. So I think that's an opportunity for him. You know, anybody that is, that says he's not a Christian because he's a gay Episcopalian, I don't think those are going to be gettable voters in the first place.
Well, you know, you're right. I mean, he is a progressive, and obviously there's going to be disagreements. But, you know, as I was reading some of the even some of the critical stuff about him, the one thought that I had was that I would like to sit and let's talk about what, you know, Christians in public life, and let's talk about the right to life and the whole question of when do we legislate morality and when do we not legislate morality, because most legislation is based on morality. Caring for the poor is about morality. You know, looking for the least of us is about morality. Defending the defenseless is about morality. But the thing that struck me was, and maybe I hope I'm right about this, is that I could imagine having a debate and a conversation about this that would be respectful and intelligent, as opposed, even if we disagreed in the end, as opposed to the normal debates that we have, where the moment you raise the issue of abortion, for example, you're going to be denounced that you just hate women. You white male old people, you just, you know, hate sex and you want to control women's bodies, and it's the handmaiden's tale. Because, and I think maybe just that element of the lack of contempt for people of faith is a huge asset for him.
Yeah, and it's our side that's preventing that from, you know, being possible. There's certainly people on the left who are disrespectful to people of religion, but, you know, you can imagine, can we live in a fantasy world where it's, you know, Buttigieg and Russell Moore arguing about this, right?
Yeah.
I mean, there is a... I think an interesting strain, you know, even in the evangelical community. John Ward is a writer for Yahoo, has done a lot of reporting and some podcasts on this, where, you know, the younger, you know, evangelicals are sort of moved by the social justice elements and the immigration elements, but that doesn't mean that they're not, you know, pro-life and you know, believe in some of the traditional values that are traditionally aligned with the right. So. I do think there's an interesting conversation we had. The fact that Pete has talked to Selena, you know, talked to Chris Wallace. I think he's done a couple of other conservative interviews. I think he's a good sign, right? I think maybe even Shapiro, or maybe that hasn't happened yet. I tweeted one thing about Ben Shapiro, and I got this crazy lefty who replies to me, "I can't support him because he's platforming Ben Shapiro." Everybody has lost their mind.
Yeah,
think that that's good that he's having those conversations.
I don't want to speak for anybody else, including Ben Shapiro, but I think that he got a little bit of pushback when he criticized Pence. So, but again, it's politics. We're going to disagree. There's going to be back and forth about all of this. But it's certainly certainly one of the most interesting debates because it's so incredibly unusual. Tim, I appreciate you spending time with me on a day that I had to fly 2,000 miles to be, 10 miles away from you. So,
Just enjoy the beautiful Bay Area weather. Get out of the podcast booth.
I am. I am out of here the moment we are done. And we are actually done. So thanks, Tim. I appreciate it.
See you, Charlie. Talk soon.
And thank you for listening to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow. We'll do this all over again.